Well, Jonah was directed by God to go to Nineveh, the capital of the Assyrian Empire, the enemy of the Jews. And his task was to warn them of coming judgment. But Jonah, God's prophet, refused. And he fled in the opposite direction. He boarded a ship bound across the Mediterranean to Tarshish. And he thought in his own mind that by doing this, he would escape from the presence of God. But God pursued his prophet. And in pursuing him, God sent a horrific storm. A storm that threatened the ship that Jonah was on. A storm that was so bad it brought the sailors to eventually toss Jonah overboard into the raging sea. John Calvin comments that God set before us this day his holy prophet Jonah as an awful example of God's wrath against all who are rebellious and disobedient to him. And yet all is not lost. And we read in Jonah chapter 1, verse 17, "Now the Lord had prepared a great fish to swallow Jonah, and Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and three nights." Many Christians today have an almost deistic view of God. They think that God is sitting in heaven, observing what we do, watching carefully and judging, but not involved, not influencing what is taking place, not even sure of what the outcome might be. Indeed, God is not governing, just watching. A God who is not in control, indeed just reacting to our decisions. After all, we do have free will, don't we? But God's word teaches that the reality is God works all things after the counsel of his own will. Not our wills. God's will. And this is what we see with Jonah. Jonah is thrown into the sea. But long before this happened, long before Jonah even fled towards Tarshish, God had prepared a great fish. God had prepared a solution to the problem that is going to confront Jonah in God's discipline of him. This word prepared is the word appointed. Before the events ever even happened, Jonah's God had appointed, he had ordained, he had decreed a giant fish to be at this exact spot at this exact time to do his bidding in regard to Jonah. And God decreed that this fish would swallow Jonah and deliver him from drowning. And it was a great fish. Actually, that's a good translation. The Septuagint, which you will recall, is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, uses the word sea monster or giant fish. It's the same word, same Greek word, that Christ uses in Matthew chapter 12, which we will get to in just a moment. It could have been a whale, and that's kind of the popular view of this, that Jonah was swallowed by a whale. Probably not likely, and there's reasons for that, but it was more likely a giant shark. And sharks, by the way, have been known to swallow people. Even fairly recently, there was a situation where a shark swallowed a man. And he was apprehended and retrieved alive from the shark. There is one case where a shark swallowed actually a 1,500-pound horse whole. So a giant fish swallowing a man is not just a highly unlikely miracle. In fact, it's not really the key miracle here. The miracle is that the right-sized fish, whatever it was at the right spot at the right time and actually accomplished what God had decreed it would accomplish. It was clearly an act of God. Just think about this for a moment. Not just regarding Jonah, but regarding life in general. If that fish had been just a few hundred feet off, or maybe 5 minutes late to that appointment, Jonah would have drowned. God's timing is always perfect. Always perfect. We don't always think so. Like Jonah, we think God has abandoned us or is just leaving us to our own resources. But no, God is watching and caring, and his timing is always perfect. This is an illustration that God does not just arrange the big things. And there are those from all schools of theology that think that God, yes, he's in control of the big things, but all the little things, that's up to our free will. It's up to our decision. But God does not, indeed could not, just coordinate the great pivotal events of history. Because the big things, the decisive events of life, are all made up of smaller things. Like the fish being at the right spot at the right time. Little details that affect the big. All things work together according to God's will. Or he could work none. God is sovereign over everything. Everything. Every little detail. Or he can be sovereign over nothing and certain of nothing. And that's not just with people. All of nature serves the Creator. All animals, the sea, the winds. And God uses them all to accomplish his purposes and his decreed will from eternity. As Psalm 50 says, "For every beast of the forest is mine," that is God's. "The cattle on 1,000 hills." Psalm 104, "He causes the grass to grow for the cattle and vegetation for the service of man, that he may bring forth food from the earth." And how God works through all of these little details, through these natural processes that accomplish his decreed will, is called providence. The giant fish was probably not miraculously created and suddenly appeared at the right spot, but rather was probably a fish that grew and became appropriate in size, guided by God's providence as it chased food and did what fish do, until it was providentially in the right spot at the right time to do what God had decreed that it would do. It's a picture that God is painting for us. Jonah, God's rebellious and sinful prophet, is running away from God. And yet God has a creature prepared, appointed, and waiting beside the ship when the fat hits the fire, The fish was there by God's appointment to save him. Jonah, the disobedient servant, worthy of instant death. And yet God is graciously watching over him and protecting him. Psalm 91. For he, God, shall give his angels charge over you to keep you in all your ways. In their hands they shall bear you up, lest you dash your foot against a stone. Now we know that's messianic. It is pointing to Jesus Christ, and yet it's true of all God's saints, all believers. God cares for his people. We are the apple of his eye. And even when you are sinning and rebellious, like Jonah, God is there, caring for you. That is grace. That is grace. The miracle here is far more than a fish swallowing Jonah, but that he was swallowed whole and unharmed. He wasn't, you know, chewed up with an arm or leg missing here and there and a few other things like that. And he was preserved for 3 days. And then he was transported by divine appointment to a specific designated location to continue to do God's bidding. Well, Jonah goes from the deck of a ship that is being tossed dangerously in this raging storm into the sea and then into the stomach of a fish. I would imagine, I don't know this, but I would imagine it was pretty dark in there. We know it had to be pretty wet and smelly and slimy. Perhaps it was deathly quiet. From the roar of the wind and the storms to the heart of this giant beast. We might call it going from the frying pan into the fire, but if things looked bleak before, they certainly look bleak now. What did our wayward prophet do? What did Jonah, who had been fleeing from the very presence of God, desirous of getting as far away from God as possible, what did he do now? Well, God certainly had his attention. Jonah, fearful for his life, starts praying. Verse 1 of chapter 2. Then, I don't know how much we ought to put in this word then. There's nothing about prayer before this. God gives directions to Jonah. Jonah starts running in the wrong direction, rebellious and disobedient, pursuing his own will rather than God's. Nothing about prayer. But now we're told he's in the belly of this giant fish. Then Jonah lifts up his voice in prayer. He prays, we're told specifically, he prays to Jehovah. Jehovah, that is the covenant God of Israel. Jehovah is the special name, not Elohim, not the generic name for God, but Jehovah, the personal God of Israel, the God who keeps covenant with his people. And it's also interesting to notice that it is his God. So Jonah now is at the place where distress and affliction is so heavy upon him that now he prays, and he prays to the true and the living God, Jehovah, but there's something else that's added on here, and it is this. He prays to Jehovah, his God. That is, not just Israel's covenant-keeping God, but Jehovah, his Elohim, his God, his personal God. He may have been wayward, and he may have been sinful and rebellious. He may have had an attitude problem. And as we go on in Jonah, we find he still has an attitude problem. It doesn't suddenly, miraculously go away. But he's still a believer. He's still a child of God. He's still a man of faith. And in faith, he lifts up his heart in prayer to his God, Jehovah, the God who keeps covenant. Verse 2 goes on, out of the belly of Sheol I cried. And Sheol, of course, is the Hebrew word for the grave. And Jonah prays, as he puts it. He calls out, is actually what it says. He calls out to the Lord. And he describes his peril in verse 3. For you cast me into the deep, into the heart of the seas, and the flood surrounded me. All your billows and your waves passed over me. It's looking pretty bleak. By the way, this poem perhaps was written after all of this took place. Or maybe in the quiet moments on the third day, as he's still sitting there. But surely it reflects his thoughts as he is enduring these things. But notice something interesting here. Jonah attributes the actions of the sailors to God. God, you cast me into the deep. Now, we know that's not what happened. Who cast Jonah into the deep? The sailors did. But in his prayer, he's acknowledging his situation and stating he understands that, yes, the sailors did it, but God, his God, who had been pursuing him as he runs in disobedience and rebellion against God, you are the one that cast me into the sea to get my attention. He's not blaming God. He's recognizing that God is in all of us. That it's not the sailors who did it. His fight is with God, a sovereign God. Reminds me of David in Psalm 51 when he's dealing with his sin and his relationship with God, and he cries out in prayer, against you, you only have I sinned. Yes, he sinned against people, but his rebellion, his sin, was really a relational thing with God himself. This is a battle between Jonah and God, not Jonah and the sailors. And where he is and why he's there is because of his battle with God and God's dealing with him. It seems in Jonah's expression here that he's thinking that his sin is such that God has abandoned him to destruction, casting him aside and out of his presence, that Jonah wanted to flee from. I don't know if you've ever been in the midst of some trial or affliction and thought that God had surely given you up to it. That God was done with you. That you were getting what you justly deserved as a sinner in rebellion against God. What arrests our attention is that God is actually saving Jonah in what's going on. This judgment, if you will, this being cast into the stormy sea and into the belly of the fish, and all that's going on there is, yes, a judgment, but it's also a saving judgment. It is the process that God is using to protect and preserve his servant and getting back to where he ought to be. God was there in the midst of the seas, caring for and protecting his wayward prophet and watching over him. Now, Jonah didn't see it at the time, did he? Jonah had no understanding of the big picture, the end of the story. All he knew was he was in trouble with God, and he knew that it was just trouble, that he deserved everything that he got, and it looked like life was over for him, and it was going to be a miserable death. When in reality, that slimy fish's stomach was Jehovah's means of saving his wayward prophet. But as we read this poem, in spite of the bleak circumstances, Jonah seems to have some hope. He longs for being at the temple again and worshiping, verse 4. Again, approaching the presence of the Lord in worship, that from which he had fled. You see, he's getting straightened out in his thinking. And that's what God's discipline is always supposed to do. God's discipline is never punishment. God's discipline is always to get us turned around so we think right and we act right about God. Verse 5 seems to express a despairing of life itself, and he describes his sloshing around in the fish's stomach, and there's seaweeds in there, and there's stomach acids, and who knows what all else. Even kind of a roller coaster ride. Verse 6, he talks about going down to the very foundations of the mountains, which is an extremely interesting expression. Who back before Christ knew that there were mountains down in the ocean? And yet now we know there are. There's as big a mountains down in the ocean as there are up here on land. And he's in this giant fish going up and down around in the ocean. And then in verse 7 he says, when my soul fainted within me, I remembered the Lord. And my prayer went up to you, into your holy temple. God has his attention. He's in despair of his life. He's caught up in an unbelievable horror, worse probably than night terrors that any of us have ever had. And it all brings him to remember his God. And instead of fleeing from the presence of the Lord, he seeks the face of the Lord. Verse 6, it is the very last phrase, O Lord, my God. That is Jehovah, my Elohim. And he stops thinking about his troubles, and he thinks about his faithful God, and he begins to pray to him. Often as Christians, we do not pray as we should until life gets so hard. For too many of us, it takes difficulties and trials and heartache for us to really seek the face of our God. Sometimes, like Jonah, we need to be almost in the jaws of death, as it were. Before we see reality, we understand priorities and seek our God. So finally, Jonah thinks about the Lord and he starts praying. Sometimes our difficulties of life, our afflictions, bring anger toward God. Sometimes even bitterness. Sometimes instead of getting this turned around as Jonah does here, we dig in our heels and we resist God even more. Sin unto death, Paul warns. But the reality is, the truth is, the only solution to life's afflictions and problems, to the difficulties that we face in life, the only solution is God. God is never the problem. God is always the answer. And Jonah realized it. And he seeks his God. Now in verses 8 and 9, very instructive. Those who regard worthless idols forsake their own mercy. But I will sacrifice to you with the voice of thanksgiving, and I will pay what I have vowed. Salvation is of the Lord. The worship here in verse 8 says those who regard worthless idols. It's the word for reverence or to worship. So worthless is a word for false or for empty. And idols is actually a word for vanity or futile. So more literally, it would be futile or false futilities. Kind of a double negative, if you will. Those who live for empty promises, those who live for futile words. Now, this phrase is used of idols, but it can be anything that is loved and worshipped, if you will, in the broad sense of that term, by loving and serving and living for something, is reverencing false or worthless idols. Those who worship or reverence vain things, which is what the world does and which Christians are always tempted to do, Jonah says, do so to their own hurt. That is, they forsake their own mercy, he says. And this word mercy is the word in the Hebrew, hesed. They forsake their own loving kindness. That is, they're harming themselves. They're hurting themselves. The pursuit of the empty vanities of the world is to forsake any hope of the mercies of God, the only source of salvation. On February 7th, 1497, a crowd in Florence, Italy, gathered in huge numbers and burned thousands of common things like mirrors and cosmetics and nice dresses and books and so on. All of these had been condemned by a priest by the name of Savonarola as vanities. Became called the bonfire of the vanities. And in that period, many such bonfires began taking place. It was kind of what we would call today a culture war. It became a title of a book by Tom Wolfe about the greed and the ambition of a bond trader, and the movie entitled Bonfire of the Vanities. Vanities. Unimportant things that become objects of reverence and love and affection that draw us away from God. Vanity of vanities. Worthless idols. The temporal replacing the eternal in our affections. We need the temporal. Some of us definitely need mirrors. But they're never to be an end. They will never show us mercy. They will never be the source of hesed, of loving kindness. We're to use them, but we're not to love them. We're to love and serve only the true and eternal God, the God of mercy and the God of grace. For salvation is of the Lord and only of the Lord. Jonah's distress has brought him to evaluate life's priorities. He sees the emptiness of temporal vanities. And he promises that no matter what distress he might find himself in, no matter how desperate the situation might be, he will only worship and serve the eternal Jehovah, his God, who makes and keeps covenant with his people. And he says he'll do so with thanksgiving. Now, this is a change in attitude. He is going to worship and serve and reverence the true God with thanksgiving. His heart is softening. Discipline is having its effect upon him. And he promises to sacrifice and to keep his vows with thanksgiving, because salvation is only of the Lord. Jonah might have had a rather assertive will. He was self-willed, obviously, but he knows who the true God is. And he knows that there is salvation, both temporal and eternal, in no one else. You know, the lying gods of the world are often enticing. Vanity Fair is alluring. And Madison Avenue has made it even more alluring. That's their art. The fashions and the fads and the baubles of the world do seem wonderful, important, and sometimes just absolutely essential. And they draw our affections. But the true child of God, like Jonah, knows that they are futile, that they are vanity of vanities. Exact same expression, by the way, as in Ecclesiastes. Vanity of vanities. All is vanity. Salvation, meaning, purpose to life, are all only of the Lord. Verse 10, so the Lord spoke to the fish, and it vomited Jonah onto dry land. 3 days of this living torment are gone. Three days of very intense career development for God's wayward prophet. And God orders the fish to act. And God only has to speak, and his creatures obey. It's interesting to notice God speaking in Scripture. We see it in Genesis 1. God speaks, and the universe comes into existence out of nothing. We come to the ministry of Jesus, and we see him speaking again and again, and miraculous things happen. The dead arise and are given life. Things appear out of nothing. Storms are stilled. Fishing nets are filled with fish just by the word of a living God. And God speaks, and unlike Jonah, a little contrast, God speaks, the fish obeys. And Jonah is vomited out, not into the ocean, to to try to swim someplace, not on a close island or close land, but actually on the eastern shore toward Nineveh. Those dark 3 days must have seemed terribly long to Jonah. And Jonah had fears that God had left him in his afflictions, forgotten and abandoned to his misery. But that wasn't so. It was 3 long days, but God had not forgotten Jonah. And at the appropriate time, God spoke. And that great fish that he had prepared before, appointed to preserve Jonah and to protect him from the dangers of the sea and to transport him back to where he ought to be going, onto dry land. We need to remember as God's people that no matter how difficult our trials, how dark our days, if you are a child of the living God, He is there, watching, protecting, caring. He does not forsake His own. And He will see you through to His desired end. You need to remember always, especially in the darkest of days, salvation is of the Lord. Only of the Lord. In all of this, there's one other important thing to note. Jonah is a type of Christ. Christ himself explains this to us. Matthew chapter 12, verse 38 and following. Then some of the scribes and Pharisees answered, saying, "Teacher," and they're talking to Jesus, "we want to see a sign from you." But he answered and said to them, "An evil and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and no sign will be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth. The men of Nineveh will rise up in the judgment with this generation and condemn it, because they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and indeed a greater than Jonah is here." This doesn't mean that Jonah died and was resurrected. It's a type. It's a picture. And there's nothing in the text to indicate that Jonah literally died in the fish's stomach. The type of Christ is primarily in the length of time. Jonah was in the belly of the fish for 3 days and 3 nights. As Jesus says, he will be in the heart of the earth, in the grave, for 3 days and 3 nights. So he is prophesying that the sign that this generation will get, the only sign that they will get, is his resurrection from the dead after 3 days in the grave. God miraculously delivered Jonah from the storm and from death. And he did so through a giant fish that swallowed him alive for 3 days before, as it were, he was returned to life. And so Jesus says, this is a picture, a sign of my resurrection. A note regarding the 3 days and three nights. This does not require 72 hours as we in the West tend to think of these things. Jesus wasn't in the grave for 72 hours, and Jonah doesn't need to be in the belly of the fish for 72 hours. It's an expression, a Hebrew expression, actually a Eastern expression, for at least parts of 3 days. I mean, it could be as little as 30 hours. A whole day and parts of either day would be 3 days and three nights. It's an expression. And Jesus' point is that Jonah's stay in the depths of the sea typifies his stay in the grave. And as Jonah was there for 3 days, Jesus would be in the grave for 3 days. And as Jonah was, as it were, brought to life again, Jesus would be alive again. Whether it is temporal salvation of a Jonah or ours, or our eternal salvation through Jesus Christ, the redemption of our souls, it is always salvation is of the Lord. There is salvation in no other than the risen and living Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Shall we pray?